This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. When rock and roll started, kids gravitated to it like bees to honey. Many just picked up a guitar and figured it out. But as rock has become more a part of the culture, perhaps budding rock musicians would be helped a bit by a bit of training. Wait, a school for rock and roll? It sounds almost counterintuitive, but it does exist, and we'll find out more about Charlotte's School of Rock later in the program. First, we meet two of the headliners at this year's Sensoria Festival. For 20 years, Central Piedmont Community College has hosted this literary festival, bringing some greats in writing to town in the process. And this year, they've done it again by bringing Richard Blanco and Joseph Pathanti to town. Both are with us this morning. Richard Blanco was invited to deliver a poem at President Obama's 2013 inauguration. His poem, One Today, perfectly summarized the feelings rippling through that crowd assembled on the Mall and watching around the country on television. After years of working in his field, he became an instant celebrity. Welcome to Charlotte. Welcome to the program. Nice to have you with us.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
Good. Joseph Pathanti holds the distinction of being this state's seventh poet laureate. His appearance at Sensoria was kind of a coming home. He taught at CPCC for a while, and today he's a professor of creative writing at Appalachian State University and writer in residence in the university's Watauga Global Community. He spoke last night at Sensoria. Thank you for being here this morning. Thank you for staying over a day.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. And also with us, we're joined by Melissa Vrana, who is Associate Dean of Arts and Communications at CPCC. I guess you're running this festival.
Yes, indeed. Thank you, Mike.
And I was kind of wrong in calling this the Sensoria Literary Festival. That's just one aspect of this. It's not just reading and writing.
Well,
it's other things.
I think it did begin with Irene Blair Honeycutt 20 years ago as the literary festival. But as you know, CPCC has grown tremendously. And we have many different programs that we like to highlight. And I think the concept of the festival is, you know, it's all for students. That's the main reason that we have the festival. And then the community is invited to come to many of these events for free. But we wanted to show all of the varied things that we do here at CPC and invite local, regional, national, and international folks.
CPCC seems to do a lot of things that you don't normally associate with a community college, this being one of them. Why did this start 20 years ago?
Well, I think, as I said, it was the brainchild of a former instructor, Irene Blair Honeycutt, and she began the literary festival. She's a poet herself. She knew Joseph Pathanti and still knows Joseph Pathanti, and started this with a group of her local friends and local writers. And then as Irene retired and we grew, we decided, as you say, we have so many programs that you don't normally associate with a community college. We had opera this weekend. We're probably one of the only community colleges that do opera. We have new 20th century music composers. We're bringing in an artist that's coming today from San Francisco, Kirsten Trudowski. She does paintings that are of old things that she finds on Craigslist, and that's very specific. Yes, a fantastic show. You can meet her at 2 o'clock today. We're bringing in Pops Muhammad. He flew in from South Africa yesterday, and he will be Thursday night in the Halton, and he's doing the ancient ancestral grooves from South Africa. And he's bringing his friend Mo G down from New York, who played on the Graceland album. Huh. And that's also a free event. So we just hope that everyone can come out and see all we have to offer.
This year, the two of the big headliners in the literary department are poets. Luck of the draw, or did you seek these gentlemen out?
It's a combination of both. I think that as soon as I heard the inaugural poem, I immediately called Richard's agent. the day of, the day, and said, we need to have him here. Our students need to see him and connect with him. And then we were lucky enough because Mr. Bethanti had worked at CPCC, right. So it seemed like a natural thing. And then Marguerite Fox, who is the New York Times obit writer, she'll be speaking tomorrow. And she's longtime childhood friends with one of our instructors, Liz Rogers. Okay. So it's a little combination of everything.
The two of you have come here to speak. You spoke last night, Joseph Bethanti, and Richard Blanco, you speak today. When poets speak, if people have never been to a conversation with the poet or a session with the poet, what do you talk about? And when somebody asks you to speak, what goes through your mind? Oh, my gosh, what am I going to say?
You know, as much as anything, Mike, I try to demystify poetry. I think that often students, especially young people who haven't had the opportunity to read a heck of a lot of poetry or didn't grow up with it, I certainly did not grow up with it. Have this notion that it's just this vast abstraction and that it's a vessel for particular things. So I try to talk about restoring people their own language, writing poetry the way they would talk, writing about anything. For instance, I kicked off my reading last night with a poem about baseball. So I write about things very germane to me, and I encourage the people I'm in front of to just write about their lives and to not worry too much about being too poetic when they do it.
Poetical.
What are you talking about today?
I would certainly echo that. I think I've certainly seen that on a large scale with the inauguration. Like when people have the opportunity to engage with contemporary work, it's just amazing and how all those sort of myths – I mean, it's just such a great feeling as a poet to see people's myths and sort of eyes open up and go, wow, like that's poetry, like, but I understood it.
Yeah.
So I think part of what we try to do as poets, contemporary living poets, is to try exactly do that, demystify, bring people to the table and say, yes, this is poetry. We've kept on writing poetry for the last several decades. It's an evolving art. It's about – there's poems about right here in your region, right here in your neighborhood. There's community in poetry. There's all ways in which people can connect with poetry, and it's amazing to see their eyes light up, especially with students, which is wonderful. As I've been doing this across the country now, you know, I sometimes feel like I'm evangelizing poetry. My mission is to have poetry converts, and I think you know, there's reasons why we hold on to those myths that would be a whole other show, but definitely that's the approach I think I go with into is to just share and, mm-hmm. and explore and let people know that poetry is a real vibrant living art.
Poetry has been with us since the beginning of time, it seems. I mean, the ancient Greek, the plays were in verse. Shakespeare mm-hmm. is poetry. It's in verse. And today, you talk about having to convert people to poetry. Is this a particularly American thing where we've gotten away from this? Is it the way we teach literature in school that kids don't appreciate it, don't get around to it? Go, ooh, a poem. I don't want to read that.
I think I've been thinking about this a lot lately this year, again, because of the response. I myself was sort of on the other, a little bit on the other side of the fence as well, thinking, oh, nobody reads poetry, et cetera, et cetera. I think there's several reasons for that. I think part of it perhaps starts in middle school and high school education. And of course, we all know what the challenges are now with, you know, the arts being pushed out of that. They just never get exposed, in a nutshell, they don't get exposed to contemporary work enough. And realize that we are writing in the vernacular of our day, right. That there are poets that are in their own regions, in their own cities, in their own neighborhoods, writing about their own communities, their own issues, and that. I don't think they get there. And then they read an older poem, and they think that poetry stopped, you know, 200 years ago.
Yeah.
That's part of it. I think the other part of it is that we're not – I don't think there's room in the classroom sometimes is left in a safe space for people to have an emotional response to the poetry. And I've heard from students a lot that turns them off to poetry a little bit. So, you know, there's not a place where people – in a classroom you have to test and you have to do this and that. There's no room really to just have an emotional response to a poem. And then students never make that connection that you can enjoy a poem, feel a poem.
Yeah, to reflect and think, which is something that education should be about, and it seems that there's not a lot of time for that in the classroom. You, though, Joseph, if I'm not mistaken, write things other than poetry.
I do.
And so I guess to a contemporary, and I hate to be insulting about this because I'm sure that the answer seems obvious to the two of you because you're both poets, but because you write novels and other things, in the 21st century, why poetry? It doesn't exactly fly off the shelves.
No, it doesn't fly off the shelves, and that's certainly one of the problems. Books of poetry don't make a lot of money. Poets don't make... Poets don't have agents. Movies aren't
Richard
made.
Does.
Well, Richard is, of course, a special case now. Movies aren't made of poems, et cetera. So it's been marginalized, although that's very ironic because there's more people practicing more kinds of poetry across the United States. It's been democratized in extraordinary ways. So that's part of why I think Richard and I are trying to evangelize these audiences. For instance, I'm traveling the past 2 years as Poet Laureate. I've gone into every nook and cranny in North Carolina, which is one of the great joys of the job. And when I'm in front of younger people, especially those middle schoolers that Richard mentioned, their chief gripe against poetry is that they don't understand it. And when folks don't understand it, they feel ignorant, they feel unintelligent, and they clam up and they shut down. There's that recoil and they never return to it. So what I've been trying to do is to connect them with poems that they do understand, that are about them, that are about where they live, and in their eyes open because it's a true discovery because they think all poems begin with "Thou still unravished bride of quietness" that some teacher laid on this poor child when he or she was 8, and they clapped down instantly. Yeah.
I actually think, I was at the reading last night, and the community college students, they love poetry. And I think that as an educator, I've been an educator for 20 years, there has been this kind of unique focus on, okay, and I do think it's important that we get arts education in K-12, but going to a symphony or opera or hearing poetry when you're 7, I think actually the community college age is a great age to get people engaged with poetry. It is the time of their lives, particularly our traditional students, 18 to 22, where they are learning to make their own decisions about...
And exploring the world.
Right. And if you hook them then, they are hooked for life, either on symphony or whatever that thing is. And arts education at the community college level is tremendously important.
I have a minute left in this segment, and you referenced this explosion of poetry in other areas other than just in a book of printed poems. And I'm assuming you're talking about things like rap.
Yeah, I am talking
about... Is rap poetry to you?
Yes. I would include rap, and I would... include certainly all kinds of performance poetry and slam poetry and hip-hop. It's connecting people with their voices and their experiences.
Exactly. That's why it's popular. They get it and they've lived it.
Yeah, and one of the things I'm trying to also tell the kids who think they don't like poetry is that they have earbuds in their ears every moment that they're awake on the planet and that actually poetry is being funneled into their head continuously.
Joseph Bethanty is the Poet Laureate of North Carolina. He's with us along with Richard Blanco, who spoke at the inauguration with his poem One Today, and Melissa Vrana with CPCC. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Queen's University of Charlotte. The Queen's Learning Society presents MSNBC's Mika Brzezinski and Joe Scarborough on April 17th. Tickets at queens.edu. And Henderson Properties, providing real estate sales and property management throughout the Charlotte region for 20 years. HendersonProperties.com. Well, as society changes, customs change. And in the U.S., the rituals surrounding death and mourning are changing. Kate Sweeney explores this in her new book, American Afterlife, and she will join us tomorrow at 9 to talk about how Americans mourn, the customs we exercise in times of grief, and how some of those customs are evolving to keep up with changing societal norms and with environmental concerns. That's all tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, advances in blood tests are giving doctors easier and faster ways to detect genetic defects, cancer, and other illnesses, what we can learn from what's in our blood.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Richard Blanco, the man who delivered the inaugural poem at the 2013 inaugural for President Obama, is with us. He's in town to speak today at 10:30 at Sensoria Festival at CPCC in the Holton Theater. It's free and open to the public. Joseph Bethanti is with us. He spoke last night at Sensoria, and he is the Poet Laureate of North Carolina and teaches at Appalachian State. And Melissa Vrana is with us, Associate Dean of Arts and Communications at Central Piedmont.
Mike, we'll be having another event tonight. So if you're at work and you can't come over at 10:30, you can come over and see a different reading this evening in the Holton Theater.
Okay. Yeah, around 7, right?
7. Okay. Yeah, 7 p.m. Thanks.
Your inaugural poem, One Today, among the things you talk about, Richard Blanco, are all the people going to work. You said cleaning tables, read ledgers, or save lives. To go to work to clean tables, read ledgers, or save lives, to teach geometry or ring up groceries, as my mother did for 20 years, so I could write this poem. Talk about your background. You are an unlikely poet, and you're an unlikely person, it seems to me, to have been asked to deliver the poem at the inauguration.
Well, I grew up, my parents obviously are Cuban, so I consider myself a Cuban-American, but grew up very steeped in the whole Cuban tradition, grew up in Miami, which was interesting because it meant growing up between two sort of imaginary worlds. One was this sort of 1950s, 60s Cuba that I had never been to as I wasn't born in Cuba, and this paradise that we left and we're supposedly going back to someday. And the other imaginary world was America because it was a very insular community and in Miami, and everybody was Cuban, my whole community, like schoolmates, mayor, lawyer, gardener, everybody was Cuban. So that was sort of, from an early age, sort of negotiating between those two imaginary worlds, which became essentially what I started writing about. How does one connect to America? What does that mean? What is home? What is belonging? What does that look like? So I would say that I'm actually a very likely candidate in that sense, because I have been writing about America in my experience and searching for maybe asking the same questions that Whitman was asking. What is the American identity? Only from left field, in a way, as an immigrant or son of immigrants, and trying to experience what that is and what is my place at the table in America. I often think that if President Obama had been a poet, I think he would have written about similar themes. His biography is more complicated than mine. But so for me, it was a very special and amazing honor to be asked to do this, because in some ways it fell right in line with everything I had been writing about and opened a new door for me. In the sense of now finally feeling at home, or feeling that perhaps I was always at home, that home was in my backyard, but also eager to explore that question of America even further, perhaps in less autobiographical ways.
You were conceived in Cuba, born in Spain, emigrated within months to the United
45
States.
45 days old. Yeah.
So you are the American experience that we tout so liberally, you know, this melting pot of people who come here from,
right,
give us your tired, your weary, etc. Is that why they asked you? How did they become aware of you? Was it a surprise to you that they asked
you? It's a complete surprise. I still don't know. I still don't know the exact details. I have my romantic versions, as I write in the little memoir that I just put out in November. I have my romantic visions of, the president absorbed in the Oval Office with my book and telling him to cancel his meeting with Putin or whatnot, or he and the first lady snuggled in bed and reading my poems. But the truth is that they've never let me know. And when I met the president in the Oval Office in May, we kind of just had a little bit of an exchange, but I think we both understood in between the lines that the beauty of that moment was better left in that mystery than rather than the, what might be mundane details and whatnot. But at some point, I imagine, it must have come across his desk.
So when they call to say, we'd like you to deliver the poem, and you, I don't know how many other poets have done this, not many.
I'm the fifth.
So it's Robert Frost, Maya Angelou.
Right. Millie Williams, Elizabeth Alexander.
You're in pretty good company.
Yeah.
So how do you approach the task? I mean, how do you not get writer's block? Seriously.
No, I know. I had 3 weeks to write three poems. I think I was the first inaugural poet.
They had to vet the poems?
They asked me to write three poems. I think I'm the only poet who never had any kind of personal, even marginal association with the administration. And maybe they're like, who knows what the Cubans are going to come up with. I'm not sure, sir. So that was definitely – but, you know, in those circumstances, I think, as in all our lives and whatever we do, you just dig deep and just – you have to bring out the best and failure is just
perfect.
Not an option.
It was perfect.
Failure is not an option.
It was perfect for the day. Did you know that when you wrote it?
No, that's the wonderful thing about the creative process in that sense that now, you know, I'm still learning things from that own poem. And as a, you know, creativity, so much filters through subconsciously and that it starts, then you start seeing yourself in the poem almost as a mirror. Oh, like, yeah, and that, and now suddenly you're making your own discoveries in your poem because the creative process is really mysterious. And one of the things that I realize has come up is my really close sense of community that I grew up with was that same thing that I embedded in the poem and that wish for the country.
Even the title is perfect. One Today. It encapsulates the campaign. It encapsulated the feeling of the day. It is a beginning and an end.
Yeah. It's true. And it's in some ways, it's one of the hardest things to deal with was trying not to be very how do you write a poem that's not autobiographical per se, but also invest yourself in it emotionally, which is a hard thing to do.
I mean, did you think about that? I mean, One Today, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but One Today means today we begin this journey in a new way. It also says we have arrived.
Correct. I mean, and it is also literally the one from beginning from sunrise to sunset.
Mm-hmm, right.
It is. I mean, one of the challenges was also tension, though. So it's perfect in the sense that for those 7 minutes, this is our wish. This is how we could be. This is how. But every poem needs a little bit of tension. And if the very closing of the poem, which is one of the hardest things to create, says waiting for us to map it, waiting for us to name it together. So it's this idea of this is who we are, this is who we could be, this is who we are whether we acknowledge it or not every day. This is us on our best behavior, perhaps. But how can we take that vision on to the next day? And as I write, we should be one today, every day.
A lot of poets speak publicly, read their works publicly, but many don't, and many just sit in their little rooms and write, and then they get published. What's it like to be on international television and sit out or stand up there at that lectern and look out at that vast expanse of humanity on the Mall in the freezing cold?
It was pretty neat. as my partner says, oh, he's nearsighted. He didn't even know where he was. No, to tell you the truth, I had a very transformative emotional experience while sitting there with my mother waiting to read the poem. And that, those moments where you're outside of yourself, and I think that's where the ego went away, that's where the fear of failure went away, and by the time, as I wrote in this small memoir, by the time I got up to the podium, it was no longer sort of Richard Blanco. It was I'm part of something larger, something so amazing and beautiful that it gave me the courage and the confidence to sort of just. It was like a gift. Like it really, by the time Kelly Clarkson started singing, I was like, "Come on, girl!" I really wanted to be there. Actually, you know, it was. I really felt I wanted to give this poem to America. I wanted, to, you know, and I wasn't expecting that. I mean, again, the professional side of us says also, you know, there, again, there's no room for failure. You know, this is the failure is not an option here. You're not going to trip on any of the words. You're not going to trip on the stage, you know. And one thing that actually was really wonderful, too, when I went up to the podium, the president and the vice president shook my hand, which I was not expecting. And that was just this wonderful gesture of saying, sort of presenting me to the United States, to this country that was mine all along. And it was such an amazing moment. It was just saying, you know, Richard, here's your country.
Wow.
And that just cinched it. And I knew they had my back literally and figuratively because they were sitting right behind me.
Joseph Pathanti, you are the Poet Laureate of North Carolina, the seventh person to be so named. I'm not sure a lot of people understand what a Poet Laureate does. So you've had the job for a while. What do you do?
You know, my job title is that I'm North Carolina's ambassador of reading and writing and literature and literacy, which is a mantle, you know, that I am honored by. So
this used to be a lifetime appointment, and then they've reduced the term to 2 years.
Yeah, it's
why? and would you like it to be a lifetime appointment?
You know, I know especially my wife wouldn't like it to be a lifetime appointment, and I think it's a wonderful process that it's a 2 year tenure because it spreads it around to different poets from different regions and different genders around the state and different persuasions, so that I think it's a really wonderfully democratic way to tackle that.
I think it's interesting that you have taught poetry in prisons.
Yes.
For a number of years. I believe it's why you first came to North Carolina, correct?
That's correct. I came to Charlotte. I landed in Charlotte in 1976 as a brand new VISTA volunteer from my home in Pittsburgh to work in the North Carolina Department of Correction. And coincidentally, my wife Joan was assigned to that same project too, up from Atlanta. So we lived for a year in Charlotte, headquartered in Charlotte, and fanned out to our prison gigs in Huntersville, in Gaston County, and also Cabarrus County. And then after VISTA, I needed a job. So I marched into Mitchell Hagler's office, who was the then chair of the English department at Central Piedmont Community College, and asked him for a job like you might ask a foreman on a construction site for a job, because that's how I thought you got a job.
And it worked out.
And it worked out perfectly.
But you've taught in the prisons and the jails, and I believe, Richard, you spent some time teaching poetry in Arlington County,
yes,
Virginia.
Yes, I did.
What is it about poetry and prisons that goes together? This does not seem to work to me, but tell me why it works.
Well, I would like to say that I meet dozens and dozens of writers per year, and so many of them have taught in prisons. So which is terrific. I'm not sure why we tend to gravitate towards that, but one finds a lot of geniuses in odd ways in prison. Something misfired in them, and that genius went this way to the bad, so to speak, instead of this way to the good. And they all have stories, and they all feel like getting those stories out are in the service also of their getting out of prison. So I think as much as anything, writers and poets, and visual artists too, and musicians, artists everywhere go into prisons to try and foster that more, let us say, positive genius in prisoners as opposed to, the more negative.
Breaking bad.
And it's not unlike going into a classroom with kids. They have stories that they've been alienated from, and within those stories lies their strength, and I think also lies the opportunity to get out of prison and do something good.
A lot of young, going back to education and to why perhaps kids today aren't attracted to poetry or turned off by it or have never seen a poem, never read a poem. You got attracted to writing, I'm told, because in high school, guys who wrote for the high school's literary magazine attracted the attention of a lot of the girls that you wanted to be familiar with. Let's put it that way.
I'm sorry you know that story, Mike, but that is the truth. When I went,
if more young men knew that story, would we have a fleet of poets out there?
Yeah, I tell the young men that's an absolute formula to begin writing poems on the spot. Yeah, I went to this all boys Catholic high school in Pittsburgh, a school that my mother fondly called a private school for Catholic hoodlums. So there were 1,600 of us, and in 1969, which was a really pivotal year for me and for the country, certainly, we had a literary magazine come out called The Spectrum. I'm sure there were 10,000 spectrums that year across the United States. And
ours was called Aurora.
Of course. And Aurora's too. Anyhow, the guys who wrote poems got all this fantastic attention from the girls I was dying to get fantastic attention from because they were sensitive. They had somehow grown feelings, and I wanted to grow some feelings too. So, but I also had fabulous teachers, and in a big praise and God bless the teachers, because it were essentially a few teachers who put some books in my hands that changed my life and evangelized me, and it is because of them that I'm was permitted to write poetry.
And you talk, Richard, about in your bio, at least, says in your mid-20s you were compelled to express your creative side through writing, prompted by questions of your identity on many different levels.
Yes. And going back even a little further, and this is something I want to speak about at Central Piedmont also today and tonight, I actually came to writing through engineering.
You are a civil engineer even today.
Even today,
that does not compute.
Yeah, I have an engineering license and a poetic license. And I got them both the same year, actually.
That's, you know, steam in action.
Steam in action, exactly. I never, you know, I was always an AB student. I was a left brain, right brain kid. But again, cultural economic circumstances and whatnot. My parents didn't, I mean, if I would have said I wanted to study anything besides doctor, lawyer, engineer, they would have been like, what? So there were very traditional choices, and that there's other reasons for it. But I never really, you know, I floated through a lot of classes, and when I got to my engineering consulting position, there was so much writing involved, writing reports, writing letters, writing studies. 50% or more of my job was writing, and I started falling in love with language because suddenly language became something alive, something that you manipulated, something that depended on audience, and that your tone had to shift, and you had to be sweet talk a permitting agent, or you had to like sweet talk a client. All these layers and dimensions of language started becoming alive, and I fell in love with it. And then I started writing poetry. And as soon as I started writing poetry, because the other thing is, you know, writing makes us think, and thinking makes us write. So as soon as I started writing the poetry, then the questions, all these questions of cultural identity and things, were the natural subject matter, which until then I kind of hadn't really asked a lot of questions about what I was living through and what my memories were.
I have like 30 seconds. Sure. Writing makes you think, and thinking makes you write. Do either of you know what you think until it's on paper?
We have an inkling. I'll say I have an inkling, but it's an iterative process. And you write something, then you read what you wrote, and then that triggers something, and back and forth. It's like a dance for me.
Yeah, I think it's chaotic in your head, and it has order on the page. Robert Lowell, in one of his poems, said, my eye saw what my hand has done.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's Joseph Bethanti, the poet laureate of the state of North Carolina. Richard Blanco speaks today at 10:30 and again at 7 at the Halton Theater at CPCC Sensoria Festival, which goes to the 14th. Melissa Vrana is in charge of that. You can find out more on our website. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Belk College of Business at UNC Charlotte, hosting an online info session for the Masters in Economics and Math Finance programs Wednesday, April 16th at 8 a.m. Registration at belkcollege.uncc.edu/connect. And PNC Grow Up Great. The first 5 years of life are crucial to brain development. Grow Up Great provides grants for early childhood education, helping kids learn from birth to 5 years old at pncgrowupgreat.com/anniversary. Advances in blood tests are giving doctors easier and faster ways to detect genetic defects, cancer, and other illnesses. And Diane Rehm and her panel will talk about what we can learn from what's in our blood, coming up at 20 minutes to 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. A reminder that Richard Blanco speaks this morning at Sensoria at 10:30. You can still go to that and see him, and you can get information about that at our website at wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Used to be, archives were filled with yellow letters and crinkled notes. That's all changed.
Authors are aware that their digital inheritance is as much part of their collection as the paper.
Their digital inheritance. Is that how I have to start thinking of my email?
I don't know. It depends on how you feel about your email, I guess.
The future of digital archives today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR News source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. If a young child wants to play the violin, there are teachers out there, even Suzuki teachers, who start with them when they're about two inches tall. If your child expresses an interest in playing the piano, finding a piano teacher isn't all that difficult. But if your child just wants to rock, then what do you do? Well, the answer can be found in the Charlotte, the Charlotte School of Rock, the purpose of which goes beyond the music, to help young people find themselves through music. Jill Living is the school's general manager. Andrea Cunningham is a parent of one of the students there, and both join us for the remainder of the hour. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
And it's Livick, not Living.
It's actually Livick.
Livick.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, excuse me.
That's okay, though.
It's okay. So this, as I said, is more. It's about more than just the music, isn't it?
Yeah, very much so. I usually say, I'd say it's about 50% about the music, which sounds strange, and then 50% about the social aspect of the school.
Well, and we'll get into that, but this may strike a lot of people as odd because at least when rock was starting out in the 50s and 60s, a lot of kids just picked up a guitar and they went to the basement or they went to the garage and they got together with some buddies and they did it. It happened.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them hit it big and others of it never got out of the garage. Why do you need a school?
Yeah, it's funny. I was actually just thinking about when I was 14 and I wanted to take guitar lessons, there was one guy in my town who sat or had an office on some strange street and you had to go way back in the like back of his store to just sit in a dusty old room and learn guitar. Mm-hmm. And that was it. That was the only way we could, you know, that was the only teacher in town.
Yeah.
Now we have this, we have a school rock and it's got, you know, gives us the opportunity to teach all these different instruments, and it's really different than it used to be even when I was growing up.
Yeah. You need the glamour, don't you?
Yes, we need the glamour.
Well, when I was same thing, part of the reason that I was even drawn to the School of Rock and for my children, my entire family is musical. My father was a musician for 35 years in a you know, party band as another way to, you know, help feed seven kids. So for me, I grew up with loud rock music in the house all the time. But I was given a French horn.
Why?
It was easier to find a French horn teacher than someone who could teach you how to rock.
But you had your father.
Who worked all the time, right? Who worked all the time. He was a busy musician. So
what an odd thing.
Right. So for me, like, you know, I could see my brothers. Like, it was also really acceptable for boys to, like, go start bands. It was like, yep, girls don't start bands. And so that was another thing. When I heard about School of Rock, I was like, are you serious that that's a real thing? Because, I mean, I could just imagine when I was a teenager, 14 years old, you know, instead of like, you know, I don't know what random activities I was doing, but I'm like, if I could have been in like a rock band and supported by adults and have it be a really awesome community, how cool would that have been?
So this is about music. You are about musicianship. It is about teaching kids how to play and how to play accurately and with some technique and to be able to use that going forward as they improve, or particularly if they want to do this ultimately professionally. But you mentioned this social aspect. What, aside from being in a band with other people, what's the social aspect about?
Yeah, it's a good question. What's pretty incredible about the school is that it's a place where you can come and you can learn how to, you know, read music. You can learn how to sight read, and you can learn all the ins and outs of your instrument. But then you walk in the door and there's, you know, 30 kids sitting in a lounge, and some of them are wearing polo shirts and some of them have spiked purple hair, and everybody's a little different. They come from different worlds and different experiences, but they all have this one thing in common, which is their love of playing music.
Yeah. And a lot of these kids, I'm told, fall somewhere on the autism spectrum. Is that by design? Is that just because they gravitate to this kind of experience? Why is that?
You know, I'm not an expert in the field, so I won't pretend to be, but it is a – I do have a large part of our student base is on the spectrum and tends to gravitate towards music.
Do you go out and try to find these people because it's mm-hmm. therapeutic, or do they just come to you because they – it's something that either their parents...
I can address okay, this, sorry. Right. Just because part of the other reason that I gravitated to School of Rock is my son has grown up since he was a toddler with a tic disorder. He has, you know, gross motor tics. He has vocal tics at times. And when you're particularly going into school, once you get into first grade and you're past kindergarten, it starts to look strange to other kids. And then, you know, you get into aspects of how do you fit in, and maybe you're being bullied, maybe teachers don't understand. And so I saw my son sort of like roll back into himself and become very quiet and shy and tense. And that was just not his character. And I just kept thinking, we need something. And every expert I talked to at some level, something came into it with music. And I just thought, how awesome if he could just bang on the drums, because he does this anyway. I brought him in for a lesson, and he was hooked, and I was hooked. And the teachers, particularly, they're not just really cool musicians in the community, which they all are. They're all super talented, but they're just so caring. Like, they really do. Every single student that walks in, it's important to them that they have a great holistic experience, not to sound too new agey. But as a parent of a child who's challenged, there's a lot of us that gravitate to it. And to see that these kids can really shine.
Well, is it the music that does it? Is it the personal attention from a teacher who knows and cares? Is it the experience of being around other kids who are doing what you're doing, and you kind of slowly, gradually build this camaraderie and the sense of trust among this group of people? What is it?
I would say it's a combination of all those things.
All of it, yeah.
I would say it's kind of a mixture of all the above.
But this is not just about kids on the autism spectrum or kids with special problems. It's
not
about kids
who
want to play. So how do these different kids, if you have trouble as a child with motor tics and things like that, and you don't fit in school, or you're made fun of at school, or people just don't understand you, so they stay away from you at school, what is it about this experience that reverses all that, at least within this group?
Well, you've certainly listened to rock and roll. I mean, you can be yourself. You can be loud. You can be crazy. You can bang your head. You can also be quiet and, you know, have acoustic folk music. And the school is so good about providing this broad spectrum of styles. They really do take each genre so seriously, and they want the children to not only be great musicians when they walk out the door, but also have an attitude that's a little more professional. And my favorite thing is when you go to a show for School of Rock, and it's adorable when you see these little four-year-olds with a guitar and you see 17-year-olds that are at the front of the stage just banging on the stage and cheering them on. So another thing I love about it is these kids right away, they just want everyone to succeed, and they're so excited for each other that, you know, it's awesome.
4 years old sounds like Suzuki. This is like the Suzuki for rock musicians. I'm actually surprised to hear that their kids that young in this, that their parents want to take them down the road to perdition that early.
Ruin them early. Yes.
What do you do with a four-year-old? The guitar's bigger than you.
It is. We put him on the drums, really, what we do with a four-year-old.
Wow, he's so good, too. Wow.
Yeah, that would be an exception to have a four-year-old. Yeah. Typically, we start around seven.
Okay. Even then, they're so small.
Even then, it's young, yeah. And, you know, at different ages, it's fascinating to sit back and watch, because at different ages, the students are really gaining different things out of their experience. You know, I found it at seven, eight, nine, it's really just about – coming in and and laughing and getting to bang on some drums because you don't get to play them at your house. And, you know, you have this house where you're allowed to do that. But then when you get more into the formative years of being, you know, in middle school and high school, it becomes much more about a place where you can go that you can call a home instead of a place that you can go and just, you know, play guitar.
When most of us of a certain age, of which I'm a member, took music lessons, we took them in this little teeny room with a teacher sitting next to us, and we would go home and we would be told what to practice, and most of us didn't, but some of us did, and we would come back. And then at the end of the year, we would have this little recital where other people like us would sit on a stage, and one by one, we'd come to the torture chamber and have to sit and have to play something in front of these this group of adults sitting in folding chairs on a tile floor in front of us. That's not what you do.
No, and you know, that kind of recital to me is just like against everything that is inside of a kid, to have to sit still until it's your turn and then quietly get up on stage and then perform your song in front of a quiet audience and then get off. I mean, that to me just, it makes me nervous even thinking about. What we do is we put the bands together, and so there's a collaborative effort. They have their teammates there, to use a sports term. And then they are, you know, we're putting them out in real music venues in charge of these. I mean, we've done the Fillmore, we've done the Visualite, Amos's, a couple theaters downtown. So we put them on real stages.
And you do this at 2 o'clock in the morning. Could you give them that real rock?
Oh, yeah. Yes. We just really want to make them go to school.
Lots of people smoking cigarettes.
Yeah, exactly. We indoctrinate early. No, we don't.
No, we do not do that.
But we do let them wear full Kiss makeup when it's a Kiss show. And we do let them, you know, Jill, they all encourage them to invest in as much as they possibly can. So that way they look uniform, they feel like a real band.
And their friends want to come to a show.
Yeah, they want to rock.
It's not just, I mean.
So you put them on a real stage in a real music venue at a reasonable time when nobody else is
right.
there. And give them the experience that they would have as an adult in a rock band.
Exactly. Yeah.
What does that do for them?
You know, it gives them a voice. It really just, to be up there and with a full light show and your band and to sound good. I mean, these kids sound good. They rehearse for 16 weeks and they put on shows that would have blown away other shows, professional bands that I've seen. And so they put on these unbelievable musical performances, and to walk off a stage and feel that.
How does it work? I mean, if I come to you and I have a 10-year-old and he or she wants to rock out, and they've never touched an instrument in their lives, where do you take them versus somebody who has a guitar, who's become okay on it, would like to get better on it, maybe has never sung? How do you in 16 weeks take these people, find them bandmates, go through enough rehearsal to have and enough education to have a set that they can play in front of an audience and sound good? How does it happen?
Yeah, that's a good question. And
Magic.
Yeah,
magic.
Well, I should back up and say that we just don't take a shy kid at 10 who's an introvert and just stick them up on a stage. We would never do that. We have beginner programs. I think Drea's son Jasper started in a beginner program, beginner band. And it's a much smaller group. There's 5 or 6 kids. There's a director who's playing with them. So we build their confidence slowly within the the walls of the school. And then we progress them that way. And so then they're led on to join an intermediate band and graduate, essentially.
And to be clear, this is not a summer camp that goes for 10 weeks and then you're done until next summer. This goes on.
It's a rock conservatory, really. Yeah. I mean, that's what I think of it.
Yeah.
Because it's beyond just, can we get him drum lessons? One thing I love about the program is my son is stuck on the drums, and that's awesome. He's amazing. But his directors are like, you know, he's going to eventually ask to play other instruments because he can't be in more than 2 songs. If he's on the drums, I have to rotate all these kids. So what happens is a kid is like, you know, well, I want to be in that song. Okay, I'll learn the bass. I'll learn the guitar. And so then you have these kids who are, I mean, multifaceted. There are children there that literally can play a banjo, the drums, the bass, proficiently.
Wow. What has this done for your son? Because he had some problems coming in. So what's it done for him?
Honestly, I mean, I think I wrote Jill thank you emails and gushy stuff like for months when I first came in. Even just his first few lessons, he's really opened up. He's a 180 from when I brought him. As far as his tics and things like that, yes, they are less. I can't, you know, I'm not an expert on that, so I can't say that. But what I can say is his personality and his confidence has just bloomed. Mm. It's just bloomed. And that in itself, to me, is worth it.
This is described as a nurturing yet challenging environment. Mm-hmm. How do you accomplish both for kids? Because sometimes kids will say, I can't do that, and that's it. They're
done. Yeah, it's a fine line. It's a fine line to be able to nurture somebody but also be pushing so that you're constantly challenging someone. So, you know, once a month, all of our teachers, we have these meetings. We all get together and we go through each student one by one and talk about where they are, you know, where they could be, what their personality characteristics are like, so that we, you know, can adjust the teaching to the student.
Mm-hmm.
We really engage with each kid individually.
This is the Charlotte School of Rock, but this is a franchise. I didn't know that this existed. There are 100 of these schools around the country, in Canada, in Mexico, and other places.
It's crazy, yeah. You know, it started in our founder, his name was Paul Green, and it started like literally in his living room. He had a group of kids he was teaching, and he was having them work on The Wall by Pink Floyd. A friend of his was doing an art gallery opening. And from there, he sent a couple of his friends out with checkbooks, and they opened a couple schools. And wow. Then it expanded. And now we're at, I think, 125 schools.
And how many students do you have to work with every on a general week-by-week basis, in 20 seconds or less?
We have about 150 that walk through the door each week.
Yeah. That's a lot.
Yep.
That's a lot to deal with. Jill Livick is the general manager of the Charlotte School of Rock. Drea Cunningham is a parent of a child who's been there for how long now?
Almost a year.
Almost a year and doing very well. And so it's a whole new concept in music education that maybe you want to investigate. Thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much.